Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. brings up more evidence that Iran is responsible for attacks on two oil tankers. One of the president's former closest allies refuses to answer congressional questions.
The idea that somebody can't answer questions, no matter how tangential, to advice to the president, I don't think a court will uphold it.
Also ahead, Santana's new album is said to be his most groundbreaking work yet. It's all on today's International Edition. Hope Hicks, formerly one of President Trump's closest aides, repeatedly declined to answer questions Wednesday in an interview with U.S. congressional investigators. With lawyers by her side orchestrating her responses, Hicks repeatedly refused to respond during the eight-hour session. Democratic members of the House Judiciary Committee want to determine whether her former boss broke the law, but they say her answers were restricted to the point of absurdity. The committee is conducting issues related to the special counsel probe of Russian meddling in 2016 in the Trump campaign. Joining us now to talk more about it is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University's Schar School of Public Policy. Thank you for being with us. So far, the White House and Justice Department have refused to comply and ordered their former staffers not to comply as well. What do you make of what's happening, given that Congress is tasked with oversight?
Well, look, at some point, the judiciary is going to have to resolve this issue. The administration is very, very loosely and casually claiming executive privilege on behalf of people who have been subpoenaed to testify. And the first and only case so far that's actually validated the notion of an executive privilege is Nixon versus the United States. And it's very hard for me to see how the administration can get a whole lot of comfort out of that, because at the end of the day, the court ordered Nixon to turn over, I think it was 18 tape recordings that he had from an internal recording system in the White House. But the court, you know, was quite clear that the executive privilege was narrow and it could give way depending upon need. So it was a balancing test. On the one hand, the need of the investigator, a court, or the Hill, the president's need for the need to have confidential conversations with aides. The privilege is also rather narrow under Nixon versus United States. So the idea that somebody can't answer questions, no matter how tangential, to advice to the president, I don't think a court will uphold it.
But won't that drag it out? This will definitely delay Congress getting in any information into any of their inquiries, investigations.
Until the election, absolutely. And I think I've commented on an earlier program that I think what he's doing is playing out the clock. In other words, the privilege is asserted, then Congress goes to court, then a lower court may find in favor of the Hill of Congress, then it will be appealed to the Court of Appeals, and then eventually the Supreme Court. Well, all that takes time. Now, there are ways in which it can be accelerated. I think Nixon versus United States, I think that there was cert before judgment. In other words, the Supreme Court took the case before the Court of Appeals adjudicated it. And that can be done. But I think the strategy of the White House is to play out the clock. The problem with it, from my standpoint, is that from a constitutional standpoint, this isn't the way the founders established our system of government, and I think it does a disservice.
The fact that the White House and the Department of Justice have just across the board, no matter what the issue is, whether it's the census, whether it's the Russia investigation, whatever it may be, they've just basically across the board said they're not going to cooperate with anything, they're not going to comply with any subpoena. Wouldn't a judge take that into consideration?
Yes, I think he would, and that's why I say eventually it's going to have to get to the Supreme Court. I believe that the court will ultimately decide against the White House. And now I understand that people have talked about it's a conservative court now. But nonetheless, the court understands the need for privilege and the limits for privilege. I guess I'd be really surprised if the Supreme Court just lay down and said to the Trump administration, yeah, go ahead. I don't think they were likely to do that.
So ultimately, in the end, you think that Congress will prevail in some of these situations?
Yes. Now, there's an alternative route, and that is for the sergeant-at-arms to round up these people and lock them in the basement of the House of Representatives. That's been done in the past. This is, you know, sort of the ultimate self-help that a branch, a co-equal branch, has against a recalcitrant co-equal branch.
That's Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. We appreciate your perspective. Well, the United States Wednesday tried to bolster its case for isolating Iran over its nuclear and regional activities by displaying mine fragments it said came from an oil tanker damaged in an attack last week, and saying the ordnance looked Iranian in origin. Iran has denied involvement in the strikes on the two tankers in the Gulf of Oman near the Strait of Hormuz. The incidents have fueled tensions that flared up with the U.S. pullout last year from the World Powers 2015 nuclear accord with Iran, and then followed by fresh U.S. sanctions to stifle Tehran's vital oil trade, and a retaliatory Iranian threat this week to breach limits on its nuclear activities imposed by the deal. Joining us to talk about all of it is Aidan Park, researcher at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Thank you for being with us. So what's your view on these rising tensions?
Well, I think I see a lot of posturing on both sides, and I think that people have to understand that this dissension is rooted in Iran's revolutionary inception 40 years ago, and that good faith has never been a currency in U.S.-Iranian diplomacy. So it's posturing on both sides, but they're both hedging on one another not staying true to the deal that was ratified in 2015. Under the Obama administration.
It would have appeared that from all indications that we heard from the UN and Europe that Iran was complying with the Iran nuclear deal that the international community agreed to with Iran in exchange for lifting sanctions. President Trump pulled out of that. Does it appear to you that the tensions started ramping up after that, or was this inevitable?
It definitely augmented the tensions, but it was inevitable in the sense that there are certain hawks in the White House circles who have always seen Iran as a threat to international society and the U.S. rules-based order. So in that sense, I think it was inevitable in a way, and I also think that the deal itself was seen by many as an imperfect compromise. And it should also be understood under the context of a declining U.S. global superpower. This was around the same time that the Obama administration sought to undertake its pivot to Asia. So it's a lot of hedging and compromising on what used to be global supremacy or uncontested the global policeman of the world.
It would appear that America's allies in Europe are a lot more cautious about what's happening here, and they're a bit in a predicament with the Trump administration putting pressure on them, particularly when it comes to, you know, not doing business with Iran, and yet at the same time, you know, they're still in the deal and they would like it to remain.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that bodes to the point of the U.S.'s declining power parity around the world, and the fact that they can't act unilaterally anymore in these sanctions, and that states like Iran and Venezuela or Cuba have options, especially with the great powers. So if Europe as a bloc has a fair bit of influence in this situation because of the JCPOA. In addition to that, Russia and China also play a large role. Russia as a military ally and China as an economic ally and also as a voice of moderation. China is still buying Iran's liquefied gas despite the sanctions and urging restraint. So I think the great powers as well as the European bloc have a lot more clout and a lot more say in what happens, and ultimately whether or not Iran sticks to some sort of compliance to prolonging its pursuit of uranium enrichment.
Iran has threatened to quadruple the level of uranium enrichment.
See, this is a lot of smoke and mirrors to this because, for one, a lot of analysts aren't sure if Iran has the capabilities to do that. But on the other hand, it is quite likely that they could have acquired that sort of technology from a rogue actor such as North Korea, or indeed had help from Russia or China in this regard.
What about the attack on the oil tankers? The U.S. says it has evidence, it has produced some photos in which it says unequivocally they believe that the Iranian military was responsible. Is that pretty much the in wide agreement?
It's not the wide agreement, but I would say from our reading of it down in Australia, I would think it's coming more to that conclusion. I think initially they were drawing parallels between this and the Iraq evidence, but one thing that should be pointed out is that the evidence is a lot more conclusive than in the Iraq case, but not as extreme in purporting a case for war. I think that when the U.S. military released the colorized photos and the video film of the purported IRGC vessel removing the mine, it sort of clarified to a lot of allies that it most likely was them. But at the same time, there are a lot of smoke and mirrors, and there's a lot of skepticism around if it could have been a setup to make it look like the IRGC, because everyone knows what their boats look like and to that effect. But I think at the moment, if you look at the capabilities and who stands to gain, it is likely that it was either Iran or an Iranian proxy who acts with a certain degree of strategic autonomy, like Hezbollah or the Quds Force.
Do you think it's possible that there could be a war, whether it be intentional or accidental?
There's a possibility of an accidental flashpoint, but I think we need to redefine the terms of what a 21st century war is and what a 21st century war will look like. If there is a war or an escalation in military conflict here, it will be, like many analysts have said, like nothing we've seen before. It won't be conventional. It won't be state-to-state based. It'll involve proxies. It'll involve cyber attacks. It'll involve market destructions, closing of seaways and international trade. And this sort of protracted warfare will damage the U.S. in ways that Iran has been very competent, specifically in Yemen and in Syria.
All right, that's Aidan Park, researcher at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Thank you so much for being with us. Well, citing credible evidence, an independent UN human rights expert investigating the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi recommended an investigation into the possible role of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman today. The Saudi government has blamed the killing on rogue officers and denied the government of Prince Salman were involved. VOA's Steve Miller has more.
The 101-page report released by Agnes Callamard into the October killing of Khashoggi at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul calls on UN bodies or Secretary General Antonio Guterres to demand a follow-up criminal investigation. She noted the extreme sensitivity of considering the criminal responsibility of the Crown Prince, as well as a senior advisor to the Saudi royal court who has not been charged. However, Callamard downplayed the focus on a single person. She wrote that her focus was mainly on identifying those who may have failed in or abused their positions of authority. 11 people are on trial in Saudi Arabia in largely secret proceedings, and 5 could face the death penalty. Callamard wrote that she obtained access to a recording of the killing on October 2nd, and she had received information about a financial package offered to Khashoggi's children. Callamard also noted limitations on her inquiry, which began in January. She received no response to her request to travel to Saudi Arabia. She wrote that she had received only a total of 45 minutes of tapes recorded within the consulate around the time of the killing, despite Turkish intelligence referencing some 7 hours of recordings. The U.S. State Department has publicly designated 16 people for their roles in the killing of Khashoggi. Many U.S. lawmakers have also criticized U.S. President Donald Trump for not condemning Saudi Arabia for the journalist's killing. Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Investigators name 4 suspects in the Malaysian airliner downing over Ukraine. A UN investigator says there is credible evidence tying the Saudi Crown Prince to Khashoggi's death. Kenya convicts 3 in the 2015 Garissa terror attack. And Trump rolls back rules to curb greenhouse gas emissions. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. On the eve of his bid for re-election, U.S. President Donald Trump claimed that U.S. immigration authorities would be removing millions of undocumented immigrants from the country. While some argue that his threats amount to nothing more than heated campaign rhetoric, his message comes as a dire warning to millions. VOA's Ramon Taylor reports.
Officially kicking off his re-election campaign, President Trump echoed some familiar themes.
We believe our country should be a sanctuary for law-abiding citizens, not for criminal aliens.
His rally comes a day after a barrage of late Monday evening tweets in which he warned that immigration authorities would conduct mass deportations beginning next week. Such an operation would require hundreds or thousands of agents and law enforcement personnel who are already overextended. Proponents argue for more resources.
I think the first thing that has to happen is the government has to have the capacity and the ability and resources to enforce the law. In other words, end the border crisis and make sure that ICE can do its job for the most part in the interior.
The timing of President Trump's announcement raised red flags regarding his intentions. But opponents warn his rhetoric has already proven to have consequences.
I think we can't put it past the federal government to do what they are saying they want to do, because obviously we saw that they went ahead with the plan to separate families at the border. And, you know, as heinous and as horrible as that was, that did not stop them from going ahead with that, right? So I think we have to take them at their word that they're going to try and do that here.
Immigration attorney Matthew Cameron says a massive roundup operation is simply not possible. But he has no doubt that fear will set in among undocumented communities anyway.
That means that people aren't going to go to their medical appointments. They're not going to go take their kids to school. They're going to skip days on the job if they really believe that there's a possibility.
On the same evening he threatened mass deportations, President Trump said the United States was preparing to sign a safe third country agreement with Guatemala, a measure that would prevent Central Americans fleeing persecution from applying for asylum in the U.S. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the Trump administration is rolling back rules to curb greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, as scientists continue to warn countries to rapidly cut emissions to prevent the most drastic effects of climate change. The Environmental Protection Agency says it has finalized rules to replace former President Barack Obama's initiative to cut global warming emissions from coal plants. Meanwhile, 10 environmental groups are suing the Trump administration, challenging the rollbacks of safety regulations enacted in 2016 meant to prevent another blowout like the 2010 BP Deepwater Horizon disaster in the U.S. Gulf. The accident killed 11 men and resulted in an oil spill that spewed over 130 million gallons of toxic crude into the waters. Joining us now is Chris Eaton, attorney with Earth Justice, one of the groups in that lawsuit. What are you suing about?
It was basically a rule that was issued during the Obama administration that instituted a number of really important safety regulations, safety measures, set standards for safety equipment for offshore drilling. And the Trump administration just last month rolled back a number of those provisions. So that's what this lawsuit is about.
This followed the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe, really, where we watched for days as oil just flowed into the ocean. Huge tragedy, huge cleanup. I can imagine there are still impacts from it. Is that what these rules were supposed to try to avoid happening again?
That's exactly right. There were, after the Deepwater Horizon, there were a number of expert panels that investigated the causes of that disaster. And what they found was there were systematic failures in terms of drilling practices, safety equipment, and regulatory oversight that all contributed to that disaster, which tragically killed 11 people and caused extensive damage to the Gulf that is still happening today. And so the Obama regulations came out of those expert panels. The panels had recommended very specific improvements that could and should be implemented to avoid another disaster.
What is your argument to the courts for this lawsuit?
I think the biggest problem here is that in 2016, the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, which is shorthand is known as BSEE, when they issued the original safety rule, they made a number of factual findings, did a lot of analysis, research, and had factual support to show that the changes that they were making would have substantial improvements to safety and that each provision would actually have a meaningful contribution to safety. They made specific findings on each one. Here, what the Trump administration is doing is getting rid of a number of those provisions that the agency previously said were important for safety and is just saying it will be just as safe when we get rid of those. They haven't actually done the analysis or provided any sort of factual basis for saying that they'll be just as safe. They are saying, just trust us. And under the law, that's what's considered arbitrary and capricious decision making, and it's illegal.
So do you feel you have a pretty solid grounds to stand on as far as this lawsuit goes?
We definitely feel like we've got solid grounds. We wouldn't be bringing a lawsuit if we didn't think we had solid grounds. You know, I think, as always, it's going to be a tricky case. Courts generally defer, are pretty deferential to agencies, and a court may defer to the agency here and say, you know, the agency knows what's safe. The court's not the expert. But again, the problem is that the agency's got to back up its conclusions. It can't just say, trust us, we know what's best, without providing some support.
So in other words, in the courts,
yes,
they will take that into consideration and say, well, you have to make your case. You can't just say, oh, it'll be fine.
Yeah, they've got to provide evidence. They've got to, and particularly in this case where they made findings in the past. And so their new conclusions conflict with their previous findings. And so you can't just ignore that conflict if you're the agency. You've got to address it and either say we were wrong the first time around or we've got more evidence that we've got a different picture here. And the agency hasn't done that at all.
And would you say that the oil companies or that are doing the drilling want this stuff rolled back? Because ultimately, you know, if something happens, they will be held liable.
They're getting a big cost savings from this rollback, and they want that cost savings. Now, it's up to the oil companies to weigh whether those cost savings are worth it for the increased risk and the increased possible liability. But, you know, that's their decision. Whereas the way we look at it is, as a nation, as coastal communities, fishermen, workers, beach towns, it's an entirely different calculus as to whether some cost savings to get more profit from drilling is worth putting the coast at risk. And so we don't necessarily trust that the oil companies are going to be thinking about safety in the same way that the public is.
All right. Well, we appreciate your coming on and talking to us about it. That's Chris Eaton. He is an attorney with the nonprofit environmental organization Earth Justice. Music legend Carlos Santana's new album, Africa Speaks, has debuted in third place on the Billboard Top 200 chart. Santana, along with Barbara Streisand, is one of only two musical acts in Billboard history to score at least one top 10 album for six consecutive decades from the 1960s on. Now, Africa Speaks debuted at number one on both the Billboard Rock Albums and Latin Albums charts. Santana's been a pioneer of unique musical artistry with a mix of rock, Latin, and jazz. And Africa Speaks is inspired by the melodies, sounds, and rhythms of Africa in what many are saying is one of his most groundbreaking albums yet. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
June 20th is World Refugee Day. On this day, says U.S. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration, Carol O'Connell, the United States stands with refugees and the international community to support refugees, asylum seekers, and displaced persons worldwide.
There are 68.5 million people around the world who are displaced. 28 million are refugees and asylum seekers. And these are people who have had to flee their homes due to conflict, violence, and persecution.
The United States is the single largest provider of humanitarian assistance worldwide, having provided more than $8 billion in fiscal year 2018 alone. We are committed to continuing leadership and the humanitarian assistance to help those in need, said Acting Assistant Secretary O'Connell. Today, some of the most serious crises are occurring in Venezuela, Syria, and across Africa. In Venezuela, families are struggling every day to meet even basic needs, said Acting Assistant Secretary O'Connell. So until the political and the economic and the humanitarian crises are resolved, the U.S. stands with the international community to support not only Venezuelans in Venezuela, but also the region. In Syria, 8 years into the crisis, 12 million persons are still displaced inside the country, she said.
They're trying to find safety and protection. The United States is committed to continuing support for those people, including the 5.7 million refugees that had to flee the country.
Finally, there are 7 million refugees throughout the continent of Africa and 17 million displaced persons. We are working with countries who are host countries. We are also working with countries who are generating refugees, said Acting Assistant Secretary O'Connell. We do not and cannot do this alone. The United States works with international organizations like the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, as well as international NGOs to provide urgent, life-saving support to those in need.
Our goal is to save lives and alleviate suffering, ensuring that vulnerable people are able to receive life-saving assistance as close to home as possible.
On World Refugee Day, we recognize the refugees themselves, people seeking asylum, said Acting Assistant Secretary O'Connell. We recognize donors. We recognize the host communities that welcome these people into their communities. And we recognize all the organizations and all the people around the world that come together to support the most vulnerable in their time of need.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. A Dutch-led international team investigating the shooting down of Malaysian Airlines passenger jet over Ukraine in 2014 now names three Russians and a Ukrainian as murder suspects.